Okay, for today, we're going to be talking about analgesic compounds, which includes NSAIDs, peptides, and alkaloids. So what are NSAIDs? Non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. Okay. Now, all of them qualify as analgesics or painkillers, or for the relief of pain. Some of them also have anesthetic properties, though. What was anesthesia? What does it mean? Rendering you unconscious, reducing your state of consciousness. We just talked about that on Tuesday. Or, I'm sorry, Thursday? Long time ago. There's obviously a wide range of different applications for painkillers. Not an entirely thorough list. And they come in many different durations of action. Now, these days, you're not going to see this sort of an advertisement. Two primary drugs for this company, one of which they still market widely, the other which they disavow now. But one of their brand names, heroin is actually a brand name. And the license to that name is still held. So anytime anyone markets heroin, they're technically violating the trademark of the buyer company. Heroin, of course, is an opiate, and aspirin is an NSAID, a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug. Technically, the NSAIDs fall within the category of being cyclooxygenase inhibitors. Cyclooxygenase inhibitors, or COX inhibitors. I don't expect you to memorize the entire cyclooxygenase metabolic pathway, sometimes called the arachidonic acid cascade, because arachidonic acid is one of the notable intermediates. But they're the reasons that we take drugs like the salicylates, which includes aspirin, the more traditional NSAIDs that have been around for decades and decades now, like acetaminophen, ibuprofen, and naproxen. And you've probably all taken some formulation that included one or more of those compounds. Those are not necessarily safe drugs. They all have relatively low therapeutic indexes. For instance, what sort of dose of Tylenol would you have to take daily to cause major liver problems? About four times the normal dose. So that's not an extremely high therapeutic index. For instance, anybody that is tempted to chug an entire bottle of NyQuil, probably not to be recommended. As a consequence of that low therapeutic index, newer drugs have been developed more specifically to target cyclooxygenases without some of the additional side effects that these more traditional NSAIDs have. And they were called COX inhibitors, for cyclooxygenase inhibitors. COX-1 drugs are mostly limited to people that have gastrointestinal disorders. But the one that was proclaimed as miracle drugs at the beginning of this decade was the COX-2 drugs, cyclooxygenase 2 inhibitors. Primarily because not only did they have analgesic effects, but they also were anti-inflammatories, which many of these other NSAIDs are as well. But they were thought to avoid most of the side effects because they didn't target COX-1s, so they didn't cause bleeding problems in the GI tract. Problem was, it was not recognized at the time that COX-2 enzymes also play an important role in normal cardiac function. And then, unfortunately, the drug companies doing the basic clinical studies covered up data that they had available that suggested about a tenfold increased risk of cardiac arrest or severe myopathy in patients taking these drugs. So it didn't damage your liver, didn't cause stomach problems, just killed your heart. So most of the drugs in that category have been withdrawn, but one of them you'll still see occasionally marketed, particularly late at night on television, that play 3 or 4 minute long advertisements for one that is celecoxib. Celecoxib. And in fact, the brand name for it was Celebrex. The others were rather dramatically yanked off the market. Not because celecoxib was any safer, it just had a stronger marketing arm to the drug company and more successfully fought the lawsuits against it. Back in 2001, I had a broken ankle. It was prescribed celecoxib for about a year. Never had a heart attack. I guess I'm lucky. But a number of people taking these drugs did. So these days, people tend to stick to the older drugs with known difficulties. Now, opiate drugs are considered to be more potent analgesics. Don't really have any anti-inflammatory properties, but they're very good at relieving pain. They also have a variety of other uses. Many of them have been marketed as cough suppressants, including heroin. Suppresses more than the cough? Hopefully not from personal experience. They're also widely used for treatment of withdrawal, to prevent the symptoms of withdrawal. And that can be a clinical use or more commonly a self-prescription, self-medication. Some of their properties that are used clinically also lead to people abusing these drugs. And they come in many different formulations. Liquids, powders, tablets, injectables. Now, the receptors for opiates have 7 transmembrane segments per subunit. So what type of a receptor are they? Metabotropic or G-protein coupled receptors. And almost all of them exist as heterodimeric forms. Heterodimers. What does dimer imply? Two sets of these, and hetero meaning different subsets, typically within the same category, and we'll talk about these different categories in a moment, but one of one subset within that category and one of another, heterodimers. They tend to be very, very strongly conserved, so the parts that are in blue here are common amino acid sequences to all of the opiate receptors, very highly conserved structures. And don't scream when you see the next chart. It's not quite as complicated as it appears. These are the categories of opiate receptors. Let's break it down and go through it slowly so everybody understands what's on here. The first are the 3 traditional types of opiate receptors. The final is one that's only been known within the last dozen years or so. The nomenclature most people are familiar with uses the Greek alphabet, mu, delta, and kappa. Mu, delta, and kappa. When the European Union got going, one of the first things they decided they would do was standardize names of opiate drugs and opiate receptors. Why they picked that, I don't know, but they didn't want to give any precedence to one of their member states, Greece, so they changed it to M's, D's, and K's. Exactly the same thing, Most literate people would have known mu was an M in Greek, delta was a D, and kappa was a K. So the more modern nomenclature, and you only typically see this in publications coming out of Europe, would be MOP for mu opioid peptide receptor, DOP for delta opioid peptide receptor, and COP, not with a C but with a K, for kappa opioid peptide receptor. Okay. They're all metabotropic. They all act through members of the GI family of G proteins, GIs and GOs. GIs and GOs. They have endogenous agonists. For the traditional ones, for mus, endogenous agonists are endorphins. Anyone heard of endorphins? Okay. For deltas, there's two endogenous agonists, the enkephalins and the deltorphins. Enkephalins and deltorphins. At least the delt helps for delta. For the kappas, the endogenous agonists are called dynorphins. Dynorphins. They all have analgesic properties. And additional ones, if you're going to become a specialist in opiates, you'd want to know more than just analgesia. They also all have specific antagonists. So for the mu, specific antagonist is ciprodine. For deltas, naltrebin, if you remember that pronunciation. And this one I always have trouble pronouncing. Norbinaltorbimide. For the kappas. Again, unless you're a specialist in these or looking at a specific disorder, these specific antagonists are not as widely used as the more generic antagonists, but in fact, mus, deltas, and kappas. Drugs like naloxone, naltrexone, and diprenorphine. Naloxone, naltrexone, and diprenorphine. Those appear to be specific for those traditional mu, delta, and kappa receptors. Now, there's an additional type of opiate receptors that shares a common mechanism, GIs and GOs. Different nomenclature. It was originally called nociceptin receptors. Nociceptin. What does that suggest from its name? Has something to do with pain. The oddity is that agonists for those receptors cause pain. Not relieve it, but cause it. They're also believed to be involved in depression. They were given the nomenclature NOPS. For nociceptin opiate peptide receptors. NOPS. No Greek letter. The endogenous agonist by most people studying opiates is called nociceptin. Nociceptin. But the same week that the paper came out reporting the presence of nociceptin, another group reported in another journal, the exact same compound. And they called it orphanin. Orphanin, because it was discovered to bind to one of the literally hundreds of G protein coupled receptors that up to that point in time had been called orphan receptors. People called them orphan receptors because no one knew what they did or what bound to them. So this was the first one that was solved. So they called it orphanin Then, of course, they got in a shouting match with one another over whose name was right. It was exactly the same receptor, same endogenous ligand. Neither group wanted to back down. So now in the literature, you'll often see it called nociceptin / orphanin receptors and nociceptin / orphanin as the ligand. So people don't take sides on this particular controversy. Most places you'll see it as nociceptin, but not all of them. It means the same thing. A phenylated form of nociceptin, phenociceptin, is a specific antagonist for those receptors. And in this case, the antagonist relieves pain. In the case of all these other opiate receptors, it's the agonists that relieve pain, not the antagonists. So although it has the same cellular mechanism of action, opposite direction of actions in terms of our perception of pain. Is that clear to everyone? Okay. These drugs down at the bottom, drugs like naloxone, naltrexone, diprenorphine, those are very commonly carried in ambulances and by EMTs in our local area. Why might that be?
Overdoses.
To treat overdoses. Where is the highest incidence of overdoses in the country been recorded? Within a 10-mile radius of where we're standing right now. Not just Plano, North Richardson as well.
Española?
Yeah, but we've recorded more of overdoses. Probably because there's more disposable income in this area. So when drugs are available, people can afford to buy more of them. And opiates do not have a very high therapeutic index. It's fairly easy to overdose on them. Now let's look for a moment at these endogenous agonists. These we call opioids. Not opiates, but opioids, because we make them ourselves. And they're relatively short peptides. Again, I don't expect you to memorize the entire amino acid sequence of any of these. But we have the endorphins, which were specific to the mu receptors, correct? Okay. What about enkephalins? What were they specific to? Okay. What about the deltorphins? Delta, that's an easy one. How about the dynorphins?
Kappa.
The simplest sequence of any of these are the enkephalins. Okay. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 amino acids long. They're two different enkephalins, blue enkephalin and metenkephalin. The sequence is exactly the same, except this peptide, this amino acid at the end, the leucine or the thiamine. So leuenkephalin and metenkephalin. And look at the structure of the endorphins. It starts with metenkephalin. And has other amino acids strung on. Look at the structure of the dynorphins. Starts with the sequence of leuenkephalin. And then other amino acids strung on. Deltorphins, completely different. Nociceptin, again, different. Don't try and memorize the amino acid sequence unless you're going to become a specialist in opioids. Okay. These come from precursor peptides. For the endorphins, for instance, it's contained within this much longer peptide that is called proopiomelanocortin. Proopiomelanocortin, or POMC. The endorphin sequence is down at the carboxy terminal end. the sequence for the major signal to release stress hormones like the cortisols and corticosteroids is in the middle of that sequence. And then a peptide that's important in regulating food intake, MSH, is repeated multiple times in this precursor. There are opioid precursor peptides for each of the different endogenous opioids. So there's a proenkephalin, prodynorphin, prodeltorphin, and pronociceptin. These have to be cleaved down using peptidases to these shorter signal sequences. So these are the endogenous substances that we produce on our own to relieve pain. Anyone know where the primary area in the nervous system where they're produced? The periaqueductal gray area. Periaqueduct around the cerebral aqueduct, around the fourth ventricle. Right, it's sort of the borderline between the midbrain and the pons. The periaqueductal gray area. Now, the majority of problems that people have with opiate receptor-related phenomenon is not because of these endogenous substances, but instead because of exogenous opiates, not opioids. These are specifically alkaloids that are produced by opium poppies. They're typically harvested from the seed pods. They're contained in a sort of a milky latex-like fluid that's exuded from the seed pods. There are very small quantities of opiates found in the seeds themselves. So you can fail a drug test by eating something coated with poppy seeds. Probably not enough for you to notice the effect, but enough to fail a drug test if it's sensitive enough. Now, there are five primary opiates contained within these poppies. The one that gives a category of names to our drug laws in the U.S. is probably the least potent of them. A substance is called narcotine. Narcotine. So what is the category of drug laws that I'm talking about? Narcotics. Those focused on narcotics. And almost any number of addictive substances at one point or another, the U.S. government has classified as a narcotic drug. Basic ignorance on the part of the government, because this is the one that they should be least worried about, narcotine. Another relatively weak one is called papaverine. Papaverine. Another weak one is thebaine. Thebaine. The two that they should be concerned about are morphine, and codeine. Morphine and codeine. These are both natural substances, organic opiates, widely used in clinical practice. Which of those two is the more potent of the two? Morphine. It's also the more addictive of the two. Turns out you could modify these natural products and increase their potency. So there are a number of modified opiates that have reached the market. The one from Bayer, their brand name heroin, the generic name is diacetylmorphine. Diacetylmorphine, slight structural change. It's an acetylated form of morphine. More common type of manipulation, to hydrolyze it, so we have hydromorphone, marketed as Dilaudid. and hydrocodone. Hydrocodone, marketed as Vicodin. And then Rush Limbaugh's favorite drug, oxycodone, once marketed as Percodan, nowadays more commonly called Oxycontin. But the generic name is oxycodone. One not as widely used because it's not as potent as some of these others, oxymorphone. So those are modified organic opiates. You take the product from the opium poppy and they just slightly chemically alter it. Then we have synthetic opiates, not derived from plant sources at all. A number of these are widely used. One that some of you may have seen used in some of the labs around for post-surgical treatment, a drug called buprenorphine. Buprenorphine. It's actually a partial agonist for the traditional opiate receptors, the mus and deltas and kappas, particularly the mus. Bupyridine, more potent, it's a full agonist. Bupyridine, marketed as Demerol, often given to post-surgical human patients. Propoxyphene, marketed as Darvon, used to be very, very widely prescribed. It's been more restricted lately, not as potent as those others. One you're unlikely to get unless you're a heroin addict being treated at a clinic, methadone, marketed under the brand name Dolophine. What's methadone used for? For heroin addicts. It's a substitute. It's an agonist purported to have less of the psychological effects. Purported because an awful lot of people in clinics where you're allowed to get the drug on an outpatient basis and carry it away, trade it to other addicts for heroin. Some addicts actually prefer the effects of methadone to those of heroin. Might have something to do with the fact that it's always the same drug every time. Heroin bought off the street, one might not ever know exactly what it is. Then we have a couple of interesting drugs down at the bottom. These are extremely short-acting but very potent opiate agonists. Also extremely tightly regulated these days. The generic, the sort of gold standard in the field is the drug called fentanyl. Fentanyl. It's often given to surgical patients before a very traumatic procedure, maybe open heart surgery or anything involving major wounds. It was noticed, number one, that the quantities of fentanyl being reported used in operating rooms didn't match up with what patients would probably tolerate. Turned out anesthesiologists were diverting a lot of the fentanyl for their own personal use. Because it is so short-acting, they could shoot up, have a nice high for 10, 15 minutes, and then go back to the next patient and repeat that all day long. And then at the end of the day, take home the remaining fentanyl. It's a very restricted drug now, and the incidence of addiction among anesthesiologists has subsequently gone down considerably. Even more potent and short-acting version is sufentanil. Sufentanil, also extremely restricted. For drugs like that, you have to account for literally every drop. And it has to be witnessed by at least one other person that it was actually given to the patient and signed under penalty of perjury. And disbarment, or actually not disbarment, loss of license by the practitioners as well. And that has semi-effectively solved the problem. But they're clinically very useful drugs because they can deal with very intense pain. And they're short-acting, so you don't have to worry about other issues related to opiates like respiratory distress and other sorts of things after they're not any longer under the care of the anesthesiologist, who would be more careful in their monitoring of breathing rates and things of that sort. Okay. So those are synthetic opiates. Now, I mentioned opiate antagonists. And this is part of why they're useful compounds. I know what movie this is from. It's Obi-Wan Kenobi as a heroin addict.
It's not the real Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Is there a real Obi-Wan Kenobi?
Yes. Yes.
It actually does a pretty accurate job of depicting an overdose. A little too much heroin. Not only does it then have the analgesic, but also the anesthetic properties, and then it has the issues with respiratory distress. In other words, stopping breathing, seizure activity, and other associated problems. So in this particular case, the guy who was selling the drugs recognizes the symptoms and does the appropriate thing, which is to call medical personnel. This particular case, they didn't have it in the ambulance. They took him to the hospital to give him an injection of one of these drugs. And he goes from essentially turning blue on his way out from the category we call living individuals back, not responsive to pain or other stimuli. And give him the injection. If they can still find a vein. And as soon as the drug gets into his system, boom, blows the opiates off the receptors. Now he's in full-blown withdrawal. And that's one of the side effects that EMTs also have to deal with for someone that is an addict, not an acute user, but someone that is addicted to the drugs and has an overdose. Now they go from unconscious, you know, uncombative, almost dead, to fighting with people around them and then probably full-blown withdrawal very rapidly.
I know it's a movie, but what about shot to the heart?
Well, that was just to keep them alive long enough, though, but they also needed something to treat the overdose. If the heart stops, that's a good way to start the heart back up. Again, not something recommended for, you know, casual users. Most people don't carry a syringe long enough to give a cardiac puncture anyway. So with opiates, it's hard to have a discussion without discussing issues related to addiction and dependence. Now, I think we discussed this individual the other day. Somebody made the comparison to the Crypt Keeper. Right? This is Keith Richards when he was the typical age of most people sitting out here today, in his early 20s, along with the other guitar player from the Rolling Stones who died of a drug overdose. This is him today, supposedly clean and sober now.
He is not.
Supposedly.
He can get high off his own, body materials, I'm sure.
Don't want to know about that. But obviously it has had some physical effects on him, even though he managed to survive multiple overdoses. Again, one of the dangers with drugs like the opiates is rather rapid development of tolerance for its effects. A rightward shift in the dose response curve causes people then to kick the dose up. What do GIs do to cyclic AMP levels? Reduce it. So subsequently, you'd have suppression of pKa activity. So typically, with long-term use, then you have upregulation of other kinases to try to keep cellular activity going. And or downregulation in the number of receptors, not only for opiates, but interestingly enough as well for dopamine receptors, which is involved in the pleasure-related sensation coming from opiates and most other drugs of abuse. Initially, most people start taking drugs like opiates for their hedonic effects, for the pleasurable effects. But over time, that rationale declines. It's no longer that they're really seeking to get high as much as they're trying to avoid being ill, the withdrawal symptoms. And of course, the fact that it has sedative properties helps relieve their anxiety over the fact that they're addicts and spending all their time trying to find more drugs. So addiction is a very powerful issue with regards to both legal and illegal forms of opiates. You might say everyone here is an addict to opioids. So if we treated any one of you here with a drug like naltrexone, you would have serious difficulties because it will block the receptors for your endogenous ligands. Most of you would notice you're in a great deal of pain. So before you get too high and mighty in discussions of individuals with addiction to exogenous substances, consider your own addiction to endogenous ones. Okay. Now, you cannot be arrested for endogenous drugs, ones you create on your own. But you quite clearly can be arrested for exogenous ones, ones that you purchase from other sources. Heroin is considered a Schedule I drug. It's a felony to possess it in any quantity. Schedule I, by definition, means having no valid medical use, no clinical use.
Is that true?
No, but that's by definition. We're going to be talking more about that on Thursday. Additionally, it's considered to have high abuse potential, along with that, no clinical utility. Well, it turns out almost any drug on any of these categories has high abuse potential. So we have Schedule II drugs. You can legally obtain those by prescription. But you're only supposed to have one prescription at a time. The quantities are supposed to be highly regulated. That's why I got this individual in trouble. Claimed he couldn't keep track of which doctor he'd been to see that day. So he had many, many, many prescriptions and several overdoses.
Rusty?
Yes.
I didn't
know. Yeah, he doesn't talk about that much. Talks about almost any other problem, but not his own. Well documented. These drugs, again, have high abuse potential, but they're considered to have clinical uses. Drugs like morphine. Probably been many, many more morphine addicts than there ever have been of heroin addicts. We talked about the use by clinicians of fentanyl. Then we have Schedule III drugs, not as restricted, easier to get prescriptions, less quantities accounted for, one that's been popularized on, again, a clinically related television program, hydrocodone or Vicodin. These are still very potent drugs, have the same risk of addiction, same potential for overdose, but they've been categorized differently. Now, the basic phenomenology when an addict cannot get their drugs is they go through a process that's called withdrawal. They feel ill. The early symptoms, and usually the sign for an addict that they need to obtain more drugs, things like excessive fluid output, not urine, but from other areas of the body. They yawn a lot. The exact reason for that brainstem reflex being activated is still not well known. I see somebody yawning right now. Hopefully it doesn't mean you're going through early symptoms of withdrawal. Loss of appetite is very typical. Anxiety and irritability. Although they're yawning, they're not capable of sleeping. Very restless. And if you look at adenylate cyclase activity, it begins to spike. The drug's no longer having its effect. Now, if they can't get drug within a few hours' time, then they go into the more severe symptoms of withdrawal. Tremors, on up to full-blown seizures. Hallucinations, or what they're often called DTs, delirium tremens. You also see that in alcohol addicts going through withdrawal. Panic attacks and various autonomic syndromes, chills, sweating, cramps, nausea, vomiting, retching, dry heaves. If someone makes it through the several days that it typically takes most individuals for withdrawal, stays clean for an extended period of time, and then are again offered one dose of the drug, very high percentage of them will take the drug, start the cycle all over again. So the recidivism is extremely high for opiates. That keeps rehab clinics in business. So obviously, the other major problem is overdose. Again, because of that rightward shift in the dose response curve, people seeking particular effects from the drugs tend to step the dose up. Some of these symptoms look similar to withdrawal. Issues with breathing, some of the autonomic signs. Cognitive impairment is typically seen. People don't realize that they're overdosing. It's very common, particularly in this area within a 10-mile span from where we are here, for people to decide they're going to go lie down and sleep it off. And their friends, being typically equally ignorant, say that's a good idea. The fact that they're turning blue and not breathing any longer should be a clue that that's probably not a good idea. Blue is not a natural color for humans. Well, we're not going back to Vedic times. Many cases, besides the respiratory distress, the emetic reflex is triggered. trying to purge things from your system. Well, if you've injected the drug, vomiting isn't going to get it out of your system. But the brain is not working really accurately at that point in time. Then you have the problem of choking on your own vomit. Unconsciousness, convulsions, coma, and respiratory distress so severe that the body ceases to function. And what kind of drugs can prevent these symptoms of overdose? The opiate antagonists. And that's why EMTs and emergency rooms and ambulances in this area are well stocked with those compounds. Drugs like naloxone, naltrexone, diprenorphine. How many of you, when you got the Just Say No lectures in high school, were taught about opiate antagonists being available? Anyone? Might have been appropriate to have mentioned the fact that there were drugs that could save people from overdoses. Particularly in this area, that might have been a meaningful piece of drug education. Not to encourage people to use the drugs, but if people were going to do it, there was a chance that they didn't have to die.
That's like talking about birth control in Texas.
Sure, so make it as punitive as possible. Okay. That's it for today.